720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us today. I always appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. Lots to do on the show today. We are going to, coming up here in just a little bit, going to be talking with Mark Horner, regular contributor to this program. He's a financial planner and president of Fairhaven Wealth Management. We're also going to hear from Danny Ecker, who's a reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, talking about WeWork, which has been a really interesting story to follow that's taken lots of interesting twists and turns lately as they've been ramping up towards their IPO. But right now we're joined by Andrew Beaton, who is a sports reporter at Wall Street Journal, who wrote about the front office at the Philadelphia Eagles, where more than half of the top advisors to the owner are women. You know, we wouldn't think that would be such a surprising thing. And yet when we look at sports and we start to look at numbers, it nonetheless is. Andrew, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Certainly. Well, so talk us through this story, if you would. You know, I feel like we've talked about the topic of, you know, women in leadership positions for so long. It seems surprising that this is the case, and yet it is. You know, how do other sports, pro sports leagues, and other NFL franchises stack up to the Eagles right now?
Well, when you talk about women in leadership positions at a broad angle, I think it becomes even more of a question mark when you look at sports leagues, and it's been quite some that most teams, whether it's the general managers, the top executives, at most teams, they're men. And that is the case in pretty much every one of the major sports leagues these days, and the NFL is no different. If you look at the number of female employees in the NFL's league office, according to a report last year, it was only 35%. And if you look at individual teams, it was 28%, and even lower numbers when you start saying, all right, not just employees, but high-ranking ones, people with the vice president in their title, things like that. And so what I found really interesting about the Eagles is they've been a really interesting organization in a number of ways in recent years. They've been progressive in the way that they've supported their players who have been outspoken in terms of social justice issues. They are progressive even when it comes to actual football in terms of how they build their roster and how they call plays. But at the end of the day, they're also a progressive organization in this regard, too, in that at more than half of their top, the people they consider their top executives are women. And given what we know about the sports landscape as a whole, that's rare.
You know, Andrew, I'm going to put you on hold for 1 second and let you chat with Griffin, esteemed producer Griffin, for 1 second. We're having a couple of technical issues, so I don't want any of these good points to be missed because they're very important, and I'm really interested in this topic. So for those of you who follow me on Twitter, which I hope that you do, please do. I'm pretty nice there. I'm at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H, over there. But after each show, I always tweet out links to everything I've talked about so you can read this stuff for yourself, because I think it's really important to just say, hey, here's the information. You can, you know, read it and take it in and sit with it and all that good stuff. So let's try this again. I think we've done some troubleshooting here. Okay, Andrew, how you doing now?
I'm good.
Okay,
sorry,
there
about
we
that.
Go. No worries. I just want to make sure we didn't miss any of your really good and important points. Okay, so let's back up a tiny little bit. When we're talking about the percentage of women in leadership positions in the NFL, that's, I think, really a spot to talk about, because we've been talking about that so broadly. I know on this show we've talked about that in a lot of different industries. We've talked about the Chicago Network's pledge here locally to get companies to sign on to committing to have more diversity on their boards. But when we switch to sports, it seems like it's still a little different.
Oh, for sure. So there was a study last year that said 35% of jobs at the NFL's league office were held by women. The number drops to 29% when it comes to senior executives. And those numbers are even lower at the team level. It is 28% female employees for individual NFL franchises, and only 18% when it comes to senior employees. So both hiring women is still a ground where both the league and the teams have a lot of room for progress, and especially true at senior level positions.
I think there's a really important point in your story, which again, I'm going to tweet out after the program. And that was in talking about hiring and talking about how this happened with the Philadelphia Eagles, that it wasn't really that they necessarily set out to say, like, hey, let's make sure we're hiring enough women. It was that the approach to hiring and retooling the front office was about diversity of thought, which I think is a really, really interesting point, because it sometimes some of the, pushback that we get when we're talking about when we're talking about, you know, more diverse corporate boards and things like that, people say, I don't care about that. I just want the most qualified candidates. This idea of coming in looking for more diversity of thought is a very interesting one, because that kind of like pushes all those arguments aside and says, let's think about, you know, what all your organization can be if you are programming and hiring for very diverse leadership thought.
Absolutely. And to hear Eagles owner Jeffrey Lurie explain it was fascinating, because he's saying, listen, I want to hire the best people and to have the best, smartest organization possible. He didn't want to hire people that think exactly alike. And listen, if you're hiring a lot of people of only one gender, you're probably hiring a lot of people who then think alike. And so basically he just wanted to hire the most talented, the smartest, the broadest group of people he possibly could. So, and often cases, one of the things that's really interesting here is that football can be a really insular world in terms of who is hired, who's hired for what jobs, what type of people are hired for those jobs. But in order to get the best candidates, he frequently hired from outside of the NFL, and in some cases, some people who had no experience in the sports world at all. And it was all a point of saying, listen, we want really smart people. We want very talented people. And in fact, we want people to come in with different perspectives who might have a very specific skill set and might even if they, for example, don't have a background in football, they might have a background in media, which is basically the NFL's big business when you break it down to its core. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting to hear that, not just how they ended up where they are, but the process that led them there.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I love kind of later in the story talking about how, you know, in particular, one executive from NBC Universal had said, okay, I'm going to go found my own media advisory firm, and then took a vacation for the, sounds like the first time in a while, and got this call about, you know, about moving into that space. That's a very good point. When we think about, oh, you know, oh, I work in the NFL, you think, oh, I work in sports. Well, not really. It really is. Media is such a big core piece of that business. That's a really interesting approach. And to me, this speaks to a very confident leader. This speaks to Jeffrey Lurie being a confident enough person to say, I want to fill in my own blind spots. I don't know everything. I'm going to surround myself with people who think differently than I do. I think that speaks to leader confidence in a really interesting way that we don't see often.
Oh, yeah, especially he again, in this world where the line of thinking among so many teams has been so similar for so long. And the person you just brought up, Jen Kavanaugh, is such an amazing example. She was an executive at NBC Universal. She founded her own media firm. And when I was speaking with her about this, she said when she was hired by the Eagles, she thought she was going to have to learn football. But what she found out was, and she thought there'd be this steep learning curve, but what she found out was, she knew everything she absolutely had to know, because she was coming in to be a leader on their media team, and she was as qualified as anybody in the world to do that based on her background. So it's this funny thing of, by reaching outside the world of football, they actually might have found the best candidate possible, because they found someone with maybe an atraditional background for the role, but it actually might have been the perfect one.
That's such creative thinking, too, I think, to say, okay, what skills do I actually need? Does this person necessarily need to know about football? Maybe not. Maybe I need someone who's an expert in, you know, accounting or media or whatever. That's so interesting to me. So when we're talking about, you know, we've looked at these numbers in terms of the NFL. What about other sports? Is it better, worse, or same in other types of sports?
Well, I think in general you see a lot of similar trends in the sports world, and it's not like the NFL is some big outlier here. But there's different examples in different leagues. The NBA has frequently done fairly well on their diversity report card, and that sort of fits in line with a lot of what people see in the National Basketball Association. It's often portrayed and seen as an extremely progressive league in various other fronts. But I think the broader point is, yes, this is a question mark in the sports world as a whole. For example, the NBA has hired a number of women assistant coaches in the last couple of years, and that's definitely something to be applauded. But at the end of the day, you can look at the sports world and see, all right, in the NBA, Major League Baseball, NFL, how many of the head coaches are women? Zero. in how many of the general managers? Zero. And so there's been lots of questions asking why has this been the case, or people try to come up with explanations. But I think the general point here is when you look at these numbers and you just take a pretty quick glance at the industry as a whole, there's a lot of room for progress.
Yeah, and I love the idea of hiring for diversity of thought. I think that's so interesting. I know another sports team we've talked about a lot on this program was the Dallas Mavericks, and how the kind of the approach there of reformatting that team under new leadership too addressed a lot of these issues too. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for being with us. Andrew Beaton, sports reporter at Wall Street Journal. We'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Have a great Saturday.
Thanks, you too. All right, we're going to take a little break. All that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. Lots to do on the show today. I don't know if you've been following the very interesting twists and turns in the story of WeWork as they ramp up to their IPO, which that has become a kind of a moving target that date. WeWork, of course, is a co-working space company here in Chicago, and regular readers of Crane's Chicago Business will know that Danny Ecker has been reporting on them quite a lot. One of their claims to fame, I suppose, is that they have over 1 million square feet of office space leased here in Chicago. But their leadership has been in the news a lot lately. Danny, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Okay, so interestingly, first we hear, okay, WeWork's IPO is going to get pushed back a little bit. Then we hear there's been a devaluation of it. Then the CEO and founder steps down. There's two new co-CEOs. There's a lot happening. So what is the latest with WeWork, especially as it pertains here in Chicago with all this leased space?
Yeah, well, the latest is exactly what you just described. A lot is up in the air right now. Change in leadership for WeWork, just a new executive staff that is figuring out, all right, how do we kind of pump the brakes a little bit on all this crazy expansion that WeWork has been doing, not just in Chicago, but really around the world, and find a way to get this company back to profitable. WeWork lost $1.6 billion last year. And so when you look at this IPO, which they were looking to do here by the end of the year, which has now been put off and, you know, postponed indefinitely at this point, you know, investors were kind of cold about them. They were like, all right, well, you guys are popular. It's kind of the trendy, you know, this trendy company. And there's a big investor that decided to put some money into them that, you know, value them at really high value. And now they're just not so sure. A lot of investors were saying, I don't buy that valuation, and I'm not so sure about how an IPO would do. And so there's just kind of been a lot of upheaval as a result at WeWork. And here in Chicago, that means that they're kind of stopping. I mean, they've been just leasing space like crazy, and they're kind of pumping the brakes now, saying, let's slow down, let's kind of reevaluate everything and see how to get, you know, some rid of some of that red ink on their balance sheet.
I mean, it's so interesting because even right along, Fulton Market area, I think on Green Street, there's more than one location. I mean, there's so much WeWork stuff.
Yeah.
And I felt like there's some topics that I know that you have been hitting so hard lately. Fulton Market is one of them. WeWork is one. Lincoln Yards mega project. I think all three of those have kept you very busy lately. But, Fulton Market and WeWork, it seems like they intersected several times on your beat. And I was thinking, why are they putting so many locations right in this one area? Because of they just seem to so aggressively be wanting to just kind of snap up a lot of space here.
Right. So that's been part of their strategy, is creating, you know, these little neighborhoods of WeWork locations. So, you know, there's a little cluster of them in River North. There's a cluster of them in the Central Loop. And, you know, in Fulton Market District, they just recently announced their third location that's in the works. So the idea here is, I mean, remember that the model for WeWork has been, you know, they just have a lot of these WeWork co-working spaces all over the world. And if you are a member of WeWork, you basically can, you know, use, and depending on your membership, can use a lot of different WeWork, you know, locations where you happen to be and if you're working on the road and traveling. So what they like to do is create kind of different types of WeWork locations, different looks to them, and they put them all in the same area so they kind of serve a lot of different types of users. And, you know, the ones in Fulton Market, I mean, Fulton Market, like you said, I mean, that's been sort of a prime target for WeWork, the one that they opened on Green Street, which was a while ago now, kind of before it was the early days of Fulton Market's transition into this kind of trendy corridor. I've heard from many people that is one of the most oversubscribed WeWorks in the country. I mean, it's just constantly, it's full. It's just like they need more space. It's interesting when you see some of these places that do really, really well and you think, okay, well, boy, WeWork's doing well here. But then you look at sort of its global, its corporate level, and you see the struggle and the upheaval in terms of leadership. It's just there's a lot of questions about WeWork, and there's kind of the questions for landlords and wondering, well, should we have a WeWork? Is that something that is cool and actually helps my other tenants and helps bring people in, or is it too much of a risk? And they don't know about the future of the company and whether that's something they want to have a WeWork in their building. So it's just a really co-working in general, but especially WeWork is a very polarizing topic right now in real estate circles.
Yeah, I remember a story that you had maybe a couple months back. That I will try to find and I'll tweet out if I can find it, that was about how landlords really have some mixed views on this, because essentially that if you have a co-working company as one of your tenants in your building, you're not going to have another. So that really kind of limits kind of what else, because of like non-compete stuff. I thought that was a really interesting point,
of
proximity to other co-working spaces, especially when you see these companies like snapping up so much land. So it will be an interesting future for WeWork, but I think for a lot of co-working, because I wonder if this has kind of put a damper on the co-working sparkle, new shiny object stuff.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's one thing that people at other co-working providers, I mean, there's some other ones that are not as big as WeWork, but that they're significant. Groups like Industrious and Spaces and Convene is another one that's been expanding in Chicago. They will say, look, don't lump us in with WeWork necessarily. Everyone has their own types of models. One thing that we're seeing a lot more of right now is some of these co-working providers are kind of doing more of a management agreement, so to speak, instead of just leasing space, which they then sublease to other companies. They kind of do a management agreement with the landlord to say, all right, we're going to have a co-working space in your building, but we're also going to, shoulder some of the risk of being here so that, in case co-working, in a downturn, everyone wonders what's going to happen to co-working in an economic downturn. And in case it doesn't go well, these co-working companies then would have an incentive to not just say, you know what, we're going to walk away from our space and sorry, landlord, do what you want with it. I think that's what landlords are trying to find some more partnerships where there's, that both have an interest in it. And, we're seeing landlords doing their own brands of co-working too. The Tishman Speyer is a big real estate owner downtown. They just launched their own little brand of co-working that they have in some of their buildings. The brokerages, CBRE, has its own brand of co-working that everyone's kind of trying to get in a way that makes sense. Certainly mimicking a lot of things about what WeWork did and whatever special sauce they have. It's a really, really interesting topic to see how it all plays out. And you've got some landlords who say, I need it because some big tenants, some companies actually require in their lease nowadays that they say, I will not sign in your building. We aren't going to come to your building unless you can guarantee me that you're going to have X amount of co-working space, because I don't want to have to, if we grow a little bit, I don't want to have to renegotiate my lease or look to leave. So by that measure, you say, well, boy, landlords need to have co-working. Of course, on the other hand, is if they build out all this shared office space and then that company or WeWork or someone else goes under, well, good luck to the landlord, and it's going to be really expensive to try to reposition that space as, a single tenant space. And so it's a very a complicated risk, and there's a lot of different opinions about what's the right amount of co-working to have, how you structure an agreement. And so it's just a really interesting topic right now.
It really is, and there's just so many pieces to it and kind of so many nuanced parts, I think, is fascinating. So thank you for talking about it with us today. Danny Ecker, reporter at Crain's Chicago Business. Thanks so much. Talk to you next time.
All right. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks. All right. We're going to take a little break, get your news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your weekend with us. So, we have a special guest in studio. We do not often have guests in studio. Usually everybody's on the phone. Mark Horner is here with us. Regular listeners will know his voice and know his excellent advice. He's a financial planner and president of Fairhaven Wealth Management. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Amy.
So, it's an important time of the year. I understand. It is, you know, I think a lot of people are thinking about, okay, if you file in a tax extension, that's the financial stuff you're thinking about. Like, okay, October 15th, I got you. I got to wrap it all up. But there's a lot of other stuff that we need to be doing, thinking about as the year winds down. And we should not, according to your sage advice, we should not wait until the very end of the year.
We should not. There could be some penalties to be paid if we don't wait. So one idea that comes to mind is flexible savings accounts. They sometimes go by the acronym FSAs. Mm-hmm. So those are plans that are offered by employers that help people save on a pre-tax basis, mostly for medical expenses. Now, those plans sometimes get labeled with a use it or lose it status, that if you don't use the money that you're contributing during the course of the year, by the end of the calendar year, you lose it. That's not always the case. There are those plans are custom designed by employers. And so some have the ability to roll over some of the money that you save in a particular year to the next calendar year. Others have a grace period. Those are all custom based on the employer design. So I think the takeaway on that one for Monday morning is to call human resources for the company that you might work at to just confirm what the guidelines are on FSAs to make sure that you take advantage of that money and don't lose it.
So my question is along those very lines, and that is that a fine print kind of thing, or is that something you usually know going into your FSA?
So again, it will certainly be outlined in the plan document.
It
could be a smaller version of stereo instructions.
That's right.
So the thing to do, I think, is to call human resources, because they're going to know right away.
That's right.
Then while you're on the phone with human resources, also confirm if your employer offers a match in the 401k or other retirement savings plan. A lot of people, unfortunately, leave money on the table by not contributing enough in their retirement plan to maximize that match. And you're really just turning down free money.
Yeah.
And so now's the time to do that, where you've got some time to maybe up some contributions during the course of the year to, at a minimum, make sure you get that match.
Yeah. What is the amount that's allowed right now, your maximum contribution on your taxes?
Yeah. So they adjust it every year. That's inflation adjusted, and it depends on your age. And you're putting me on the spot for specific numbers. I want to say under age 50, it's $19,000. And if you're over age 50, it's $25,000. But again, human resources is going to help you with that on Monday.
And this may be a silly question, but I think it's an important one, because I don't know. I get this question. Maybe someone else does too. Does your employer contribution count towards that $19,000, or is that $19,000 in addition to your employer match?
That's a fabulous question.
Okay,
we rarely hear about. So the numbers that I just talked about were the employee contributions.
Got it.
And there are two different buckets. So not to get too much into the weeds, but it's the IRS 415 limit, if you want to look at it. And what the 415 limit says is the total amount of money that can go into a retirement plan. And they distinguish between employee contributions and employer contributions.
Okay, I feel less dumb for asking.
Not at all.
That's important.
And those numbers go into the $50,000 range total.
Okay, so if you do have an employer match program, you could be leaving a ton of money.
Absolutely.
On the table.
Depending on the match, which again, it goes back to that same issue with the FSA. It's specific to that employer plan. But no, this could be real money that you're just turning down.
Well, that's important.
Absolutely.
Okay. Glad you're reminding us of these things. And then what about, you have talked recently about something called donor advised funds, which are very interesting, but I don't know a ton about them, but they look fascinating.
Well, and you're not alone.
Okay.
That donor advised funds, by many sources, are the fastest growing vehicle in the personal financial world. And essentially what they do is they make your philanthropic activity more tax efficient by using, instead of cash to make charitable contributions, appreciated assets. And again, I'm reluctant to go into the weeds too much on this. So we do have a white paper that's only about 2 pages long on our website. The title of it is called Stop Writing Checks to Charity. And on the surface, that might sound like we're Ebenezer Scrooge,
right.
which is not the case. It's
sure.
it's meant to the title is meant to reinforce the idea that writing cash when you're doing making your charitable contributions might not be the most tax efficient way to make those contributions. You might instead look at contributing appreciated assets, and donor advised funds play a huge role in being in helping people be able to do that.
That's really interesting, because I think we think about that kind of stuff as like philanthropy means you have millions and millions of dollars, and you can, you know, like we just saw this week that Ken Griffin now is, it's going to be the Griffin Museum of Science and Industry, right? Like we think of philanthropy being like that, but I think at its core, I think any of us can do a philanthropic act by giving, and this is just kind of a way to do it in a smarter way.
It absolutely is. And I want to say the average balance out there in donor advised funds these days is something like $25,000 to $30,000, which is still a lot of money,
sure.
but it's not billions.
That's
so
right.
the minimums are typically end up being $5,000, you know, relatively small amounts. So very much a vehicle open to many of us.
Yeah, 5,000 is a little more doable, you know.
Than a billion. Yes.
I feel like. And so then how do the mechanics of that work? So if you're like, okay, I want to, you know, give at the end of the year X, Y, Z to this charity that's important to my family, it's as simple as moving it out of that fund, or is it, how does that go?
So it's a little bit, so you could do it that way. You actually have a few more nuances available to yourself. So you could, let's say it's $10,000 that you want to give to charity this year. And let's say that you have a stock that's gone up in value to $10,000 that maybe you only paid originally $6,000 for it. You give the $10,000 value of those shares of stock to your donor advised fund, which you can name whatever you want it to be. You get a full tax deduction for the value of the asset. So the $10,000, not what you paid for it. So in this example, not the six, fully what you paid for it. You don't realize any capital gains from the gain that you appreciated. You get the full value. You then have as the name implies, donor advised fund. As the advisor on that fund, you then make decisions about where that $10,000 goes and to what charity and when. So you could decide that you're just going to send $1,000 a year to your favorite charity, your alma mater, or whatever organization you'd like to benefit. And so it's a great way to, in some cases, accelerate charitable tax deductions to help offset maybe a high income year. So where we've used it a lot is pairing it up with a Roth IRA conversion. Income tax liabilities come along with converting a regular IRA to a Roth IRA and pre-funding a donor advised fund with maybe your charitable goals for the next 5 years is a great way to match that charitable deduction in a year that has unusually high income. So that's one way that they're used, but very flexible.
That sounds really interesting. And you know, I think when we think about, okay, get all your tax receipts together, like, okay, I gave this to Salvation Army when I clean out my closet and I get this. And, you know, you kind of scrabble to get stuff together at tax time, but this seems like a lot more organized, calmer way to go.
So you are hitting the nail on the head. So in our white paper, how we describe it is compressing our charitable decisions through the course of the year from what you describe here and there to one decision.
I see.
So at the end of the year, you make a decision. This is the number for me that I'm going to contribute based on my financial circumstances and goals to the donor advised fund. That's it. So from a tax perspective, you've got one decision, and then you decide from there how you pass that on to the charities.
And is that fairly flexible year over year? Say you have a big year and then a not so big year the following year.
Incredibly flexible.
Okay.
Could be zero. There are no annual requirements. Could be zero in 1 year if you've had a big financial event in one particular year. It could be more. Your distribution options to charities are incredibly flexible. Those can be one time. You can set up monthly recurring contributions. A great way to get the kids involved if you want to start to teach them about philanthropy and the importance of that, if that is
yeah,
personally
like
important.
Goal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
That's cool. I feel like we should be talking more about this stuff.
Lots of people are on this topic of donor advised funds.
Yeah,
but yeah, check out the white paper. Two pages, real short read.
For those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet it out after the program so you can all find it and take it in, see if it's the right move for you. And then one other thing I want to talk to you about before we run, and that is how I feel like we've talked about this topic before too, and that is how there are very smart people on both sides of the law. And
there are
people, I mean, and it ranges, right? It ranges from very good doctored looking emails and links. And even the other day I got a phone call asking me,
right,
telling me I was at risk for having a car repoed that I paid off in 2008. So
right.
Really? And I haven't owned it since 2011. So I was like, really? Are you going to repo that? Because I think it's probably not running anymore. So good luck to you, you know. But there's so many, you know, and they sound authoritative. And you're like, wait, and if I did actually have a car, I'd go, wait, what? You're going to, what? Wait, no. Hey, stop. It's current. So I think stuff like that is, you know, very important to talk about when we're talking about protecting ourselves financially, because we can step in things very, you know, with very good intentions, and suddenly it's a big problem.
We can, and the bad guys have gotten more sophisticated, and there's all this information. You mentioned social media, that they can do their research on people in advance to identify points of connection, and it's very, very sophisticated operations. These they tend to target older people. So if we're sort of tying this into kind of year-end things, mm-hmm. we've got the balance of the calendar year has got all sorts of holidays in advance of us where family is getting together. And I would encourage everyone, because it's always worth repeating, I would encourage everyone to talk to specifically maybe older aunts, uncles, grandma and grandpa, and remind them that there are bad people out there that are looking to prey on their and take advantage of their desire to be responsible and honor these obligations, and to think about any solicitation, email, over the phone, very skeptically.
Yeah, and then of course, whole other time, we need a whole other hour to talk about like data breaches
we
and
do.
Things like that. That
we do.
You know, that's been so in the news this past year of credit bureaus, data breach, things like that. That then you're not like, well, it's out there somewhere. What do I do? And, you know, you can just kind of monitor your credit for the best, I think.
So real quickly on that one. So just as another reminder that, again, bears repeating all the time, texting, emails, you never share right account numbers. You never make reference to your financial institutions because the bad guys, again, are sophisticated. And so don't make it easier. Don't help them.
Don't help. I say that all the time. Right. Mark Horner, thanks so much for being with us. Financial planner and president of Fairhaven Wealth Management. And again, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet out links both to Fairhaven Wealth Management and then also the white paper that you mentioned.
Thank you.
I think that's super interesting. All right. Well, we'll see you next time. Thanks
Looking
so
forward
much.
To it.
All right. We're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Well, that does it for me here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And I'll be back here tonight, 7 to 9 p.m. for a Saturday night special. I'm going to be talking about all kinds of fun stuff there. But now let us visit with our friend Scott Catoon. You need a microphone.
I'm like sitting here looking and talking to you.
Yeah.
I'm like, there's no mic in front of me.
Well,
this is weird.
What's
going
on the show today?
We have really a cool show, actually. We have an extra half an hour, which makes it, you know, always better.
Because of the sports ball, right.
Correct.
Right.
So we're going to start off talking about, I think we talked about this last time, with Katie Lynch from Codeverse.
Oh, yeah.
You're familiar.
Love
so,
her. Yeah.
Yes, Katie is in the green room right now, having a great time. And Todd from the Lyric Opera is going to be here. And they're doing a little partnership for kids. And we're going to get into that and how it just, we have talked about this numerous times, you and I, on the crosstalk about how important marrying math and coding with creative.
Yes.
It is
definitely.
Without one, the other is more or
you
less useless. And so we're going to talk about that.
So co-host. They've teamed up.
Yes.
Ooh,
yeah.
I'm excited about this.
Yes.
Okay.
It's going to be very cool.
Cool.
The other part, Vic Piscucci, who's the managing director of Lightbank, which is the, you know, kind of the premier VC in town, is going to co-host the whole show with me. And we're going to hear some pitches. And the difference for this show, I think, as compared to all the other shows that we've done with the Startup Showcase, is a real VC who tells it how it is, is here to hear the pitch with me. So I'm very nice normally. And then we have other right. founders who usually are like, I get it. You know, you're going through growing pains. Real VC. So pitcher beware.
Yeah, so probably less lenient because it's like, I've already heard it all.
I mean,
I already know the pitfalls.
I told him to be a nice boy, but... but no, and you know, here's the thing. I think it's really important for all these founders and people to hear the truth. I think it's more valuable.
Yeah. I mean, I would rather hear, hey, you don't have XYZ piece thought out well enough for your business, than get there later and fall on my face.
Yeah. Or if you are going to give me a reason why you don't think this or that, constructive criticism or something I should look out for. I would rather that than be like, yeah, it sounds great. Oh boy.
Yeah. And then I think you as the founder can make a decision, go, well, okay, I'm going to fix this, that's a good point, Or are you going to kind of double down and say, no, actually, I think this is a core part of my business. I'm not changing it. I'm going to go somewhere else.
Yes.
I think it makes you do some soul searching as a founder.
I agree. And for the listeners, for the purpose of the show, I think what makes it dynamic is that you get to hear an investor break it down and really like understand what it takes to build a company. I think it's fascinating. It's a good, this will be a good learning. And if Vic does well, he's probably listening in the other room. If you do well, Vic, you'll come on every Saturday.
Cool. All right. Well, Scott Catoon is coming up after the news. All right. Thanks so much for being with us today.